Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, 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 what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Yo, yo, check this out. This is your girl, Cola Vogue, and I'm chilling with my boys right here on Off the Cuff Radio. Because we off the cuff right now. You dig?
What's up? It's your boy, Lil Yaka, UNLV. Ragging up from the river. Cooling with my homies and my family at Off the Cuff Radio. Y'all be sure to tune in on Fridays and get the latest scoop and find out what's happening. You hear me?
Tiffany Levine.
And it's Queen Crazy, your girl's favorite bartender.
And we're from
Sex on the Rocks podcast.
Alright, you're now tuning in to Off the Cuff Radio.
Yeah, because they keep representing that world hip hop. Well, much love.
Alright.
Y'all, this is Miss Irresistible giving a shout out to the live show on Friday nights Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey y'all, this is Stacey Lachey giving a shout out to King Eric and Off the Cuff Radio.
What's shaking, y'all? This is the Grand, one half of Lost Cause and one third of that Drive Time thing. Sending my love to the homies over at Off the Cuff Radio. Tune in every Friday night for some real, deal hip-hop conversation. These dudes are the connoisseurs of this thing. You already know what it is. BX Stand Up, Hud City, what's shaking? Peace.
Yo, this is Joe Fresh the Dime, and y'all tuned in to the most raw, uncut show on radio. The Guillotine Team, Off the Cuff, and yo, Eric Sandman, off the these clowns.
Transmitting live via satellite. Yeah. One, two, two, three, two, the four, two, the five. You know the time when we rock the spot. Artifacts, New Jerusalem, catch rack and get the box. You know the time when we rock the shit. Team one and MCL, we be the ultimate. We bring forth the sorts in rap sports. Niggas play the bench sport. Overtime as niggas wanna shine. Divine with the intricate shit. Who wanna bring it? To the table able, now we're stable on the disc. The Heineken bottle catcher, trotcher, slasher, dash the bastard with the fat ass capture. No moonwalk, my tunes talk about a fucking loan. Throw me home, I'm in the middle like I'm old. Love to do dubs on deck without a mic check. Collect no check, but catch wreck on set. Deuce, deuce is loose, TPP represent C. Death Squad, Boom Squad, and Artifacts make three. Like Dennis Scott dropping one for the wisdom. Cause when I get some, I'll be fucking up they system. All temperatures cheer when I appear from the mist. Priceless, I just and never see another Christmas.
You play risk when you're dealing with the New Jerusalem through blitz. Without the use of two clips, niggas got still be fluid. The cat, bearing with the terror offhand. Without bands, we rock spots in all land. Niggas be playing and we stand for the substance. Subject, the basement, MCs be patient. Cause all that rushing, save that shit for the dressing. Yes, we stand strong, whack niggas, we address them. You know the time when we rock the spot. Artifacts, New Jerusalem, catch wreck and get the pop. You know the time when we rock the shit. Team 1 and MCO, we be the ultimate. You know the time when we rock the spot. Artifacts, New Jerusalem, catch wreck and get the pop. You know the time when we rock the shit. Team 1 and MCO, we be the ultimate.
Test me, the best beat, check it for my recipe. Mess with me and I'll be draining all your fucking energy. Galactus tactics match wits, I'm from the brick. I used to catch a switch from any walk by bitch. But now it's to the break like this jock. This rock is hot, got props and plus plus shots for what I got. Don't sniff shit but snot hop. You better watch the snot box, I'll diss you. Then I'll clear the air like Scott tissue. The issue got a barcode on funk mode. So now I pack a trunk load of skunk for the underground chunks. Cause I bumps to any system, who dissed them? Watch me back them up from all the way from New Jerusalem to Manhattan. Satin and silk, killed the best built. I guess the milk was no good, so now I'm classified as true hood. Check this nigga, live on Kodak tips or bust a pimp. Cause I'm not a boogaloo shrimp. Same one, the Jesus and the Judas. Cause when I hit the Buddha, my problems manifest as deep rooted.
You know the time when we rock the spot. All the facts, no
chest rack and get the pot. You know the time when we rock the shit. Came one and MC out, we be the ultimate. You know the time when we rock the spot. All the facts, new to do, catch rack and get the pot. You know the time when we rock the shit. Came one and MC out, we be the ultimate. MC, universal no rehearsal on tap with rap. So, magnificent, sufficient, all that. Tall facts from the 6-footer. In slang, I be the gooder. Good S, best, put the rep, act that's less. Sub, like a wreck, sir, prefer tracks to measure. Size up, MCs that need the wise up. Fucking they lives up. Urban survivalist, live with this. Flow style, tribal, that get all up in your shit. For all reasons, number one, you're sleeping. Speaking like a deacon, catch the drop, my props leaking. Speaking on the deep end, thinking while I'm thinking of ways to play my competition without blinking. The ink's on the sheet with rhymes that are unique, complete batter. Astounding feats, your wit don't matter. Capitalize while I'm categorized. The GL to the tame to the O-N-E. You know the time when we rock this spot. Artifacts, new Jerus, catch wreck and get the pop. You know the time when we rock this shit. Tame one and MCL, we be the ultimate. You know the time when we rock this spot. Artifacts, new Jerus, catch wreck and get the pop. You know the time when we rock this shit. Tame one and MCL, we be the ultimate. You know the time when we rock this spot. Artifacts, new Jerus, catch wreck and get the pop. You know the time when we rock this shit. Tame one and MCL, we be the ultimate. You know the time when we rock the spot. Artifacts, new Jerus, catch wreck and get the pop. Nigga, you know the time when we rock this shit.
What it is, what it do. We are now at episode 393 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric the Great. And I got my co-host of the building, T-Max with the Facts.
What it do, what it do. Thursday Night Thunder, OTC up in the building. Sponsored by DaVinci Clothing, Dirty Basement Radio, Buddy Boy Entertainment, and Jesse's Boutique along with Core Financial. It is myself, T-Max with the Facts, and your head host, King Eric, and we are live and direct with another, with another spectacular show. And one thing about it, King, is, you know, we're so proud of with the show, man, is that not only do we just talk about hip-hop culture from the aspects of the rhymes, but also we weave into those conversations so many other elements. And, of course, when you're looking at the essential elements of hip-hop, DJing, b-boying, hip-hop, in terms of rap, there's also one of the most fundamental elements, which is graffiti. And our guest tonight is one of the most legendary MCs, one half of one of the dopest groups ever, one of the most astute, artistic, talented, articulated, and dope artists. We got L the Sensei in the building representing NJ. What it do, man?
Peace. What's going on?
What's happening, brother?
I'm all right. Sitting here watching the Knicks play basketball, even though we losing right now to San Antonio. But I'm good.
Look,
we in the playoffs, though. We in the playoffs. I can say that.
Drop that bomb for him.
Yeah. Look, L, Julius done big things for y'all, man. Look, y'all got Julius Randle, RJ Barrett. The future's looking bright for y'all, man.
And he just made a shot as soon as you said that on cue.
it's been a long time coming, man.
It's been a minute.
Y'all can bring it back to the glory days.
Yeah, I mean, like, even if they don't this year, that's a good thing to see these guys actually, you know, they're all young, so it's good to see them playing like this, you know, because we always have one star trying to carry the team, and now you see this all from scratch, and it look good.
Yeah, and you know, y'all, in terms of just the marketing and just for tradition, I'm a diehard Bulls fan, of course, but I got much love for New York. And it's always good, you know, when a big market like New York and all that, you know what I'm saying, that especially with such a tradition, you know, shout out to the OGs of it, like Patrick Ewing, you know, John Starks, Dave DeBuscher, Walt Clyde Frazier, you know, you know, all those guys, Bernard King, you know, everybody, man, you know.
And they got a good coach, so they needed this, you know. Woodson was a good coach for them too, and they, you know, kind of moved him out too fast, but this is
right.
Cool to see. So I'm happy for them.
Yeah, but it's always good.
Yeah, they had to find ways to fill the garden up.
It took a pandemic for them to get it right.
Yeah. But it's a long time coming. So, I mean, you know, the Master Sensei of the MC Way, man, it is an honor. It is a privilege to have you on with us, man. I guess we get right into it, man. I mean, in terms of, you know, your journey from the beginning, you know, representing, you know, Newark, 973, stand up, you know, to now, you know, from the days of way back, you know, because, of course, you're one of the noted, you know, legendary graffiti artists, and then from your transitioning to that to MCing, you know, tell us about your journey from the beginning. What inspired you in terms of, first and foremost, your love of artwork?
Well, I always was an artist growing up. I've been drawing since I was five. Getting into graffiti was a gradual thing because of the fact that I did draw. I drew, you know, my own comic books. Just, you know, being into Marvel, DC, you know, you integrated with graffiti. When I first saw it, I knew it was something different. But when I went to New York, it was totally different. And my father, he wasn't really letting me out. Walls and be all, you know, on the street, you know, at night. And in Jersey, it wasn't too much, you know, going on like that if you didn't know about it. So I would say Tame and Artifacts pretty much represent that part of our group where he was like really, you know, we both do graph, but he was like in it. So he was in yards in New York. He ran with like Big Cruise, FC, TC5. You know, whereas in Jersey, you know, if he wasn't going to New York, he wasn't really doing that. So my whole upbringing with it was like I was a b-boy first, and if you was into the culture as a kid far back when we was coming up, you pretty much got into everything. So you knew a DJ, so you would go over his house or whatever and practice. He would teach you things or you would learn things. So I was doing pretty much everything. At 12 was when I first went to New York, and I went to the Bronx Zoo, and I saw graffiti in my face for the first time, where even going to all the documentaries you see about hip-hop in New York, early Grandmaster Flash, Melly Mall, Wild Style, you watch those movies, and, yo, it was like that.
Yeah.
When I walked outside of the train to see, it looked like a war zone. But when I got on the train, I just was staring at the train like, oh, my God, like, this is what I heard about. So, you know, my father, when we was walking away from the train, I'm still looking at the train going by, just like, whoa, okay, I see this inside the train, all the tags. I'm like, damn, like, this shit's crazy. So I was in it from that point, you know. And then we went home from the zoo, and I got home that same day. Star Wars movie came on, and my father was really looking at me like, you think you're going to be doing this? I was like, yeah, I'm going to be doing that. Probably not to that effect, but I'm going to be into it. I'm going to do it. So, and growing up, even in the hood where I'm from, you know, as a teenager, when you started seeing graffiti, yeah, it was more or less Tame tags. And my man, Corno, J. Rude, Energy, you know, these guys was the only people I seen doing pieces and tags in the area. And just so happened, Tame was an MC too. So we was with a crew of dudes, we was called the Boss Mob. And my man Rhino, CMZ, was like the Molly Mall of the crew, and we just was all rhyming. He would make all the beats. So when I was coming over his crib through my man Jay Byrne, and I also had a mutual friend through Tame, through Jay Byrne and myself that knew Tame. That's Polar Weiss. So I'm over Rhino's crib, and I see all these tags on the wall. I'm tagging on the wall, but I see Tame point. I said, yo, that's the dude I see on the wall. He's like, yeah. He said, he'd be over here. He's like, yeah. So he played me some of his songs. I'm like, damn, my man rhyme good too, and do graffiti, do graph, good. But it was like his rhyme style went along with his name, the way he tagged. So that was crazy. So I know I went off into a whole bunch of stuff, but as far as my graph coming up, that's, you know, pretty much in a nutshell.
No, it's all good, L, because, of course, when you spit it on the wrong side of the tracks, you was like, breaking was my thing. I used to spin the wax. I never thought I'd spin
mm-hmm.
the... You said breaking was my thing. I used to spin the bat, but I never thought I'd spin wax with tracks to make your hands clap. I could have
exactly.
gone the other way, but no how. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You and Tame come from a very long line of distinguished artists. I mean, just to name a few, I mean, you've got Scene, you got Zephyr,
mm-hmm.
Phase 2, Banksy, Blade,
yep.
Kenny Schiff, Les Quiones, Lady Pink, Jean-Michel Basquiat, you know, Tracy 168, mm-hmm. Dave, you know, Cornbread, you know, Dez.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is just to name a few.
And they're about to do
I
a
mean,
special on Cornbread. I saw a documentary they're about to have about him.
That's dope, man. So, I mean, you know, coming from Jersey, man, I mean, y'all definitely, you know, had a, you know, got legends come from there, you know, shout out to the late, great Whitney Houston, of course, Queen Latifah,
mm-hmm.
you know, Naughty by Nature.
Yep.
What was it like?
Red Man, Lords of the Underground.
Yeah, Red Man. Can't forget Red Man. I mean, you know, the funk out the spark. I mean, what was it like for y'all coming up and following tradition in that capacity?
Man, so, like, let's talk about, you know, even Lakim Shabazz. You know, that's one of my mentors. He was one of the first dudes in Jersey to come out officially with good records, you know, 45 King. And, you know, Latee was, you know, the Flavor Unit early was like, you know, Apache, rest in peace. You know, a lot of these guys paved the way, you know, even for Naughty when they transitioned into that, you know, joining the Flavor Unit and Latee were putting them out. You know, this area where I'm, where I live, and where it's not too far from where Redman used to live and do it all, it's like 5-10 minute, like far spread out. Like we all did the same talent shows. We all saw each other come up. Like we was at Cent Club Sensations when EPMD snatched Redman out of that club, and we didn't see him for a minute until he started making that album. And you know, we was happy for him because like we all, you know, everybody in Jersey sounds different. You know, and that's the one thing I like traditionally about us, that we all try to break out of Jersey in a way where we all sound, Poor Righteous Teachers, YZ, we all sound different. No one sounds the same. So that's the originality in Jersey that I like, where that differentiates us all as artists, but that hunger in us wanting to be accepted by New York is what drove all of us to be as good as we were. And still today. So, you know, when people say East Coast, or when they sometimes mistake us from being, because when we first came out, everybody thought we was from New York. Everybody thought we
right.
was from Brooklyn, you know, because I'm wearing all this polo, Tang got dreads, that, you know, they might have thought he was Jamaican or something like that. But when they saw the video and they saw New Jersey Transit, Newark Police, they was like, oh, this dude's from Jersey. So they didn't think that the kind of hip hop we was doing, like, existed in Jersey like that. Like, when I say that, I say that in the sense of, far as the culture of what you said in the beginning, the elements of all the tools that been that are used, and our records show that in what we was doing. So that was the tradition that we had to keep up, knowing that we come after Lords, we come after Redman, we come after Naughty, we come after all of these people I named before us, and we have to make sure that we repping in the same vein as they were.
And that's dope, man. Go ahead, King. Go ahead.
Yeah, we was going back and talk about you coming up in Jersey. And now one of my introductions to Jersey was the movie that came out in 95, New Jersey Drive. Now, is that
mm-hmm.
really a reflection of how Jersey was really living at that time? It was really that wild?
Nah, I'm going to tell you like this, bro. It was wilder than that movie. That movie couldn't really show
Whoa.
Everything that was going on. That was
Ooh.
Happening and yo, dude, like, I'm talking about them cars they were showing, they were stealing them in the movie. Nah, bro. These dudes was like the youngest, I would say, stealing cars at that time. And that height was like 12 years old, like, and older. But it was mostly like teenage dudes, like, in the, you know, late, early 20s. You know, if you saw an episode on Cops on real TV, it was a park. And these dudes was in a Honda Accord. And the cars that still in the hood easy was Hondas and Acura Legend. So it was a scene on Cops where these dudes in a Honda Accord in this park, Weekway Park. And this park is it's like roads you can go to get out of the park and get in through the beginning of the park and in the back of the park. These dudes got away so fast. I mean, and my man, had jumped on the back of the car to get into the sunroof and get, and they were going, still going fast. My man got in the sunroof, sat in the car, and he bounced on the police, but they were stealing cars that from the port, and where it's like they stealing from the before they go to the dealership. So they stealing NX7s, they stealing Benzes, BMWs, like anything, everything fast. They would come up the streets and going up to, they'd go to the white area and steal cars up there. It got to a point where the streets had to make the road bumps in the road to stop these cats from going in the back areas of these good-ass neighborhoods getting away, because the border was like right there. So the movie also was showing shit that like they was trying to mash everything together. Like, so the stories of like the people and the cats in the van and they got shot up, like that was crazy. Like, they were trying to mix so much together, but like the era of the carjacking was real, where they had to make laws in the streets where cops couldn't chase these kids no more because they have accidents in the street where they're killing people. You know, it was reckless. It was reckless. So the mayor didn't want, like when Heavy D was like, yo, y'all can't bring that shit on Avon Street. It's called Avon Avenue. You know, they shot that shit in Brooklyn. They didn't shoot that movie in Jersey. And, you know, it was a, the mayor didn't want that light painted on the city. You know what I'm saying? Even though the mayor was kind of corrupt a little bit, but he just didn't want that, like, to still to this day, we are known still as the carjack capital of the world. So it was a black eye a little bit. But it was real as hell.
But y'all had that dope soundtrack, man. That's one of the best soundtracks from the 90s, bro.
It was dope, but I was trying to get us on it, and I was mad. I'm calling Tommy Boy like, how y'all going to have this damn soundtrack and not have us on it? And we from Jersey. So that was the one strike I'd give to the soundtrack.
Yeah, it was missing some flavor from you guys, though, man.
Yeah, they had a lot of New York dudes on that record.
Yeah, for real.
But it's cool. But and it was probably karma because the movie ain't do too good anyway.
Yeah, it was more so like one of them street flicks, like, you know, them instant classics. It's one of them cult classics,
yeah,
as I would like to call it.
I would say so, because, you know, some people still, like, don't understand that movie. But if I give y'all some tips on some things that was going on, I can use some write-ups and shit like that where you see, you know, it was ridiculous, you know, and they had to make a task force just to catch these dudes, or at least get it somewhere like where it was, it would go down, and it did.
Yeah, it was great. Hey, T-Mac, you there?
He probably going.
Yeah, he have a little technical difficulty going on with him. But going back to what's going on with you, man, and how you guys was coming into the game, man, how did you and Tame One click up?
Well, yeah, like I said, we had mutual friends, and once we got to meeting at my man's Rhino crib, we did like one song together, and something we saw in each other where we was like, all right, you know, we did another song, and then we just started doing more songs, and then we started hanging out, started hanging together, and I was in my area where I lived at, I went to school with Naughty by Nature, so all the contests that we did, I was in with them, and I would come runner up most of the time, or, you know, if they wasn't in it, me and Tame would win. But it was once I got with him, all my stuff started changing. And when he got with me, he was from across town. So he was living in East, where I lived at. And he was kind of new. So we was able to do a lot, you know, as far as in the, you know, the talent shows we had in the local circuit, because we all did them. Naughty did them, Lords did them, Redman. We all did all the shows in the neighborhood. So once everybody started getting on, you know, me and Tame was like one of the last groups to get signed out of the, you know, the ones that we named so far. And then after us was like Outsiders and Pace One and all of them. So, you know, me and Tame went up to Stretch and Barbido, and we got invited there because Tame won a contest on the phone for the freestyle. And that was the invitation we got to go up there that night. And that's how we got our deal. And we ain't looked back since. So, you know, I think Tame was calling up that night because we both were listening to Stretch and Bob, but this week, that week he called up, I didn't listen. But then I had called up and they was like, yo, y'all good just off a team joint. So we went up there and just blew it up.
Yeah, well, people listening just tuning in about Stretching Bobito, man, you care to be more detailed on how much of a big deal
that show was
at the time for a lot of underground acts?
Yeah, so Stretching Bobito show, 89.9, or as we would say, 89 Tech 9, was one of the most prolific college radio shows in the country. You know, and it was broadcasted out of Columbia University in New York. And this show would come on at like 1 in the morning and be over at 5. And they would play every damn thing. And they would have artists come up in the middle of the night, whether if it was us, Hieroglyphics, Dell, Doom, I mean, like, you name every New York rapper, they've been up there, organized, Lost Pro, you know, you name it. And a lot of us all got our starts up there, you know, but me and Tam got our deal there, where it was like all of New York would be listening. And if they wasn't listening, they was taping the show. So if you're familiar with taping shows, whether if it was Marley or Red Alert, like, with Stretching Bob, though, at 4 in the morning, your tape might pop, and you got to wake up and turn it over. So you wouldn't want to miss what they were playing. And you have, you know, friends that would, you know, tape the show, too. And you'd be like, yo, did you listen last night? And this is how much every Thursday everybody was listening. So we knew, you know, once we went up there, that was our, you know, time to shine. Because, like I said, you had to go up there and be right. And you couldn't go up there messing around, you know, you really had to be good to get invited up there. That wasn't just some regular show. That was really like you showing your skills for real. And that show is historical. You know what I'm saying? They have a movie out right now, Stretching Bob, about the radio show. You know, Busta's in it, Fat Joe, Jay-Z, everybody been up there. And they all knew going up there, you know, what it was about. There was no bones about it.
Yeah, and that was the cool part about that show, too. It was the simple fact that those guys, they focused on spitters mainly. It wasn't, they weren't focused on guys that was really trying to come through with a lot of melody, but they were more so focused on guys from the north, south, east, west. You had to come with your A-game with the bars.
Right, and trust, it would be dudes from everywhere that came up there, West Coast, east, you know, whatever. Even down until, you know, it wasn't so many Southern artists coming up there, but when they did come, they knew what that show was about. Even when they got on mainstream radio on Hot 97, it was the same. It's just that they was on mainstream. But, you know, that was their reputation. And you had some guys would go up there, you know, they'd be nervous. You know what I'm saying? And some dudes would go up there, and everybody not a freestyle MC, but they went up there knowing they still had to do it, and they would give their best. I would say the best dudes I would say that have been up there on that level, like Natural Elements, them dudes was nasty with it up there on the freestyle. Like, I just had it on the tip of my tongue. Like, Cellar Dwellers, they used to go up there and burn shit up. You know, Natural Resources, Gene Gray, Wale, we all been up there.
Man, that was just a magical time, man. And that's what
early 90s. You know, that's when it was still, hip-hop was still, it was a teenager then. It was still growing up.
Yeah, and on top of that, it was also like a jungle, man, because if your skills and your barbs and your swords weren't sharp, there wasn't a high chance you wouldn't be able to get back in the studio. You feel me?
Nah, right, because, you know, and when we put out our album, you got to understand, we was putting out an album in the same week as Redman and Method Man, Keith Murray, Biggie, you know, and we competed. You know, because we had a song that was different from everybody else's song. It wasn't a song so much, say, displaying our lyrical skill, but it was intertwined with a background of what we felt we did as kids growing up that we still did do today at the time. So it worked out, and, you know, we did a song that we didn't know people was going to love so much to say, you know, that was what they also did. You know, you make songs to relate to what everybody like or what they do or if they relate to you. So that song pretty much stuck out for us and still now.
Yeah, and going back to creating that album, man, like, what was the mind frame of y'all going in there? Like, y'all was trying to go in there expecting to knock out, like, a classic to stand out?
Shit, nah, we just went in there happy as hell. We had a deal, and that we was able to contribute our vision of what we feel is our brand of hip-hop. And if, you know, you get in this shit to do that, you're going to make, you know, nobody going to say that, you know what I'm saying, because your purpose is to make money too. But for everybody that you heard in the 90s coming up with their first albums and first everything, it was because we were proving a point and staking our flag in hip-hop and say this is who we were, and, you know, and you had to be nice. You wasn't nobody buying your shit if you wasn't even up to that caliber. So, like I said, when you coming out in a store where they putting your shit up and next to all these other MCs, I said, whether it's Biggie, Nas, I mean, we had to perform around that and still be like, yo, we who we are, and we from Jersey, and we represent hip hop for all these elements, you know, and people, they latched onto it.
And what I remember,
you know,
about
that,
we didn't know we was gonna make
a classic record. That we just knew, with the beats that we had and the songs we were doing, we was like, okay, we got something. We knew that much, but we didn't know what people would think about it. That was the scary part about doing it. You know, you never know what people are gonna think, and you know that's up to the label to do their part on that. You know, we got to make it, but we got to make it easy for them too. So we had no idea. Working with T-Ray, Buck Wild, Redman, you know, we didn't know.
Very underrated.
That, right, we didn't know working with those guys that we was going to make those kind of songs, but I'm blessed that we did.
Man, talking about one of the biggest songs that y'all guys put out, man, Wrong Side of the Tracks, man, that's one of the, that's what made y'all stand out to me, man, because see, y'all brought the little jazzy feel to that.
Right.
Because everything is so hardcore at the time. You guys created
that
balance.
Yeah, with T-Ray, you know, working with him, it was easy because he would let us sit in the basement with him and ask us what we would want. And pretty much, you know, we worked with him, you know, through the section of the album that he did, you know, part of most of the songs. So we would go to Brooklyn, and we vibed out with him to a point where he knew after a while what you know, type of shit we would like. And when he did Flexing with the Tech, we was coming in the studio. I remember getting off the elevator, and we heard that bass line rumbling through the room, like the hallway. And the closer we got to the room, we was like, damn, what is that? And he was putting the drums on it. We walked in the room, we looked at him, he was like, what's up? And he's Southern dude, T-Ray from down south. So he had a ponytail at the time. He said, hey, what y'all think? We said, hey, who that shit for? He said, hey, what y'all want? Y'all want it? We said, hell yeah, we want that shit. And yeah, we sat down at the table. We had just came from uptown. We was up in Harlem getting some bud. We sat at that table, threw all the weed on the table, all the blunt, and we sat there and wrote that song right there. And because we knew if we didn't take that beat, somebody else was going to get it. And that shit came out dope.
Especially around that time where what dope beats was so easy to purchase at that time and everybody wanted them. It's like you got to get it as soon as you can.
And it wasn't a lot of producers that would, you know, it was T-Ray, Beat Nuts, like Q-Tip, and all these dudes would go to beat, like showcases, like record showcases, and would go digging. And, you know, T-Ray at the time and still got a lot of records, and he was working with Double X Posse, he was working with Cypress Hill, a rock and roll group named Helmet, and so he was able to, you know, he had an extended catalog of records, so we used to go in his basement like, damn, it was like a sea of records. And when he was making them beats, man, like, I remember he made Dynamite Soul, the original version. I remember him playing that bass line and looping that shit up, and I remember being at his house just sleeping over, waking up the next day, making more beats. And that was a process that I liked, that I didn't think we were going to do. You know, you never know what you're getting into when you're doing this shit. Everybody will figure it out once you get to doing it. But it was like a dream, you know, working with, seeing all these people, even getting, you know, busted on the remix, but come on to get down. But with Ronside, it was like New York dudes fell in love with that record because it was what their childhood was. And they didn't realize that our childhood was the same. We just didn't have New York train system. You know, but we was right there, right across the water. They think, oh, y'all in Jersey, y'all in South, down South. No, fucking, because we ain't in New York, don't mean we country. But, you know what I'm saying, we right there. We get we watch Video Music Box like y'all. We got the same channels. It's just y'all channels are different. We watch the same thing. We right there. We can see y'all buildings, man. Come on. So, you know, that when we came out with the record, KRS-One did a review on Hot 97 of the single, and he said it was crazy that a group from New Jersey made a song about something that started in New York and made the shit sound good. But that was just us being students of what we saw. So, and we happened to be, you know, also another thing with graffiti and this element at the time, even with Tame, there's not a lot of black graffiti artists out there like that. You know what I'm saying? Whereas, like, we were on record talking about it and on video. And, you know, people see us doing it. Even when we do our tags on autographs, people bug out. Like, oh, shit. But, yeah, we really do graffiti, yo. There's a lot of other rappers that do graffiti, too. Lost Pro, Master Ace, you know, Fat Joe, KRS, you know, a lot of dudes. Yo, you know who's nice on the graph? Dilated Peoples, both of them. Evidence and Rocket is nice on the paint. I was like, damn. Trust me, super nice.
Hey, T-Max, you back on?
Yeah, I'm back. Yeah, man. But I mean, right. I was just listening. Hello.
Yeah, a little bit technical. Let's go.
Yeah, I had a little bit of technical difficulty and everything, but yeah, man, I was listening in. I mean, you know, for Columbia University at Ivy League, I mean, to, you know, all, I mean, and you know what, that was crazy because all the stuff that was coming out during that time, man, I mean, of course, 94, you know, when the album dropped, I mean, you know, Nas's Illmatic dropped, you know, Biggie's joint dropped, you know, Method Man, you know, Red Man's albums dropped that year. You know, did you all know when the record hit, like you said? Craig Matt too, from Project From the World, absolutely. The first album released on Bad Boy. You know, did y'all know exactly what was going to come in terms of y'all being regarded so heavily as one of, like, the best acts? Because I know when I first heard Wrong Side of Tracks, I was in love with it when I first heard. I was like, yo, who are these kids right here?
I would say once we put the record out, because, like, you know, a lot of people was playing the record on the radio, and once we put the video out and people was able to watch the video and see what we looked like, see that we was into graffiti for real, I think that made for people wondering what the rest of the album would sound like. And only thing we wanted to do was just do what we knew to do of all the things we did growing up, of when we couldn't afford studio time or get certain production. I was doing most of the beats. My man Rhino was doing the beats. My man Pig Arthur was doing the beats. So we were doing everything on our own until we got the deal. And we was able to do it professionally, working in a big-ass studio. And we was like, oh, shit. So, you know, once we started doing that and we was able to get used to doing the record, because we were still doing the album when Wrong Side came out. So we was, you know, finishing certain stuff up. So, you know, we had, like I said, we had no idea. We just was thinking about people that was like us. You know, like, what would these type of motherfuckers feel like with these songs for them? You know, because, like, how we, you know, I didn't think people were going to look at things like how I did. Like, I would buy records, sit down, look at the cover, look at the credits, look at the lineup, you know, all of that shit, just analyze it. And I knew because we were doing the graph, you know, graffiti, and we talking about that, that made a difference for people to focus on more than just us being MCs on the record. And a lot of people, some thought that maybe we were just graffiti artists trying to be MCs. And that was quickly disintegrated. So, you know, we made a song about what we do, but we also are performing MCs. Like, we do the regular thing too. It's not a cliche thing we're doing. We're not trying to, you know, we really active into battle and all that stuff we were doing.
Now, what was some of your favorite records from that first album? That was a major standout.
Oh, man, of course, Wrong Side. But I would say, like, Way Back was one of my favorite songs because even though that song took the longest, it was one of the more perfect songs on the record, like, mix-wise. I Had Fun Doing Low With A Boom. You know, he was altering my voice. You know, that was funny. It was fun, though. And that was actually the first day I smoked weed, too, in that session. Come On With The Get Down was special. We had a lot of our friends in the studio doing the hook with us. You know, just working with Buck Wild and Rock Raider. You know, RIP to him. He was our first DJ on Wax before we got Chaos. You know, so all of these things were just happening, man. It was like random, not knowing Rock Raider was going to turn into the damn DMC champion. Because he was DJing for us and Showbiz and AG at the time we was working with him. And he was doing all the cuts on the record. He stopped doing cuts for us after the Dynamite Soul remix with Mad Skills. So all them cuts on that record, that's rated.
Man. So in going that, so the record is taking off. And you care to tell us some stories about what the tour life was like, man, because, you know, that was the first time you guys going on the tour. And who were you guys touring with specifically to promote that record?
Well, when we, the label asked us what we wanted to do, they was like, y'all want to go on the East Coast promo tour first or West Coast? We were like, shit, West Coast. I never been on the plane either until we did that. So, but the only thing we knew about West Coast was movies and Crip and Blood. And we was like, oh, shit. So we going over here. I'm all poloed out. I knew I couldn't wear certain stuff. But we got over there, man. That was the best thing we could have ever did. Because I'm still able to go to the West Coast like I'm going home to this day. Like, I'm going back out there next month. And I'm like, we did the best thing going there because, you know, when they asked us, I'm like, we're not from there, so let's go there. And we was out there for like a month. We went to every place in L.A., every radio show, every college, every Oakland, we was everywhere. So we kind of, like, made it out there, you know, to a point where, you know, we was able to do things and see things where we didn't think nobody was even going to like us coming from, you know, the East Coast. So we get there. First MCs I meet is Tash from Alcoholics. I'm hanging with him, bugging. I'm like, oh, shit. Like,
shout
I felt like we were in the club.
Yeah, you man.
Tash, my
shout
dude,
out
still to this day.
Shout out to Tash
right
as well, because, yeah, shout out to Tash Alcoholics, the Liquid Crew, man. Tash is a good friend of ours. You know, we've had him on the show a couple of times. Good dude. You know, one thing about it, man, is, you know, like y'all was saying, you know, when the record dropped, you know, and when everybody saw the visuals for the video, which were just some of the illest I've ever seen, you know, Tame bought in the game was something that had not necessarily been talked about as much, let alone on Wax. But really to have that visual representation, that artistry articulated for us, I mean, you know, it was really dope. I mean, when I think of that gritty 90s era East Coast boom bap hip hop, y'all automatically are right there, you know, and really created that soundtrack. I mean, I remember the first time, you know, when the Source magazine hit y'all in the Sure Shot singles, I got to send you that picture, you know, from where y'all were in it, man. I mean, they said these kids are like going to be really the next big thing, man. I mean, you know, but I know one thing about it in terms of when y'all going in the studio, I mean, you know, you know, everything that, you know, you have been in New Jersey, like all the life experiences, you know, what did you find most about, you know, transitioning into that game in terms of once, you know, you became MCs and then really seeing the other side, traveling the world, you know, like y'all were talking and just really, 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 really understanding not only in the United States hip-hop culture, but in places like Japan, Italy, you know, Europe. What was it like to see that?
Well, everybody thinks that, like, even when we first went to Europe in 95, like, year after we put the record out. And in 94, we went to Japan when we put the record out. So At the time we went to Japan in 94, we went with Stretch Armstrong and my man DJ E. Kim from New York. And the only artist that had really been out there like that was like Wu-Tang. B-Nuts was there. Nas was there. Maybe Farside. Yeah, Farside was there. So, and De La and Public Enemy.
Right.
So it wasn't a lot. But we got, right. Man, that was crazy, bro. I mean, like, we only did Osaka and Tokyo, but we did, like, three or four shows. We did two shows in one night. Like, we did an early show, and then we did a later show. And it was ridiculous. It was so crowded, but then it was like, I've been to Japan in 99. I've been there in 2013 and then 2018. And it changed. Every time I was there, it got more loose and more hip-hop, more participation from the Japanese culture in hip-hop. I've done a lot of songs with a lot of Japanese artists through my years going out there. A lot of European artists. You know, it's like people say, oh, they appreciate hip-hop more. I'm like, nah, man. Like, yo, they love it. It's, you can't say appreciation no more. Like, for years, I've told people that. Because they, it's like when you watch basketball. You see how fast the Europeans caught up to how we play ball. It was like that with hip-hop when the internet came. So, you know, whereas we would go places where, man, we was in places in Europe, you would think hip-hop was not even there. Like, I'm talking about sheep in the meadow. And you're like, yo, it cannot be hip-hop here, yo. Like, no way. And we get to the club. It's Easter Sunday. We get to the club. It's popping. I'm like, what? What is going on, yo? And they be these young kids. And you know, I tell people our crowd is young, B. Like, we go to Europe, it's not, you know, only way it's got our age there is if, like, you know, they really come to see us, like, first time in ever, or they older and they DJs or producers that's from, you know, that time, and they with the kids, and some of them bring their sons or their nephews and shit like that. So it's real genuine with these cats out there. I mean, it's the same at home, too, but because we spoiled to it, and we made it, and we had it, and, you know, to them, it's like the big shit, because they don't live in New York. These people think that when they come to New York from Europe, as soon as they land and get in Manhattan, they're going to see rappers walking around like wilderness. And it's not, it's, you know, not like you that. Have to go somewhere to meet somebody or go to a club or some shit like that, but you know, they come to the shows, because they know, like, yo, we're there, and they, like, yo, these dudes don't know when they're coming back. You know, and they buy the merch because they know, like, I'm not paying for shipping. You know, these experiences that we have going overseas, I've never take for granted, because it's always different when I go. And there's more people I meet, they get younger, you know, and the older cats that come are happy to see it. Because, like I said, they just collect records. They have a stack of records in their hand waiting for us to finish the show. And I'm signing all of them. Could that be the dude that's buying them all the merch, too? But it's like, you know, you go to all these shows, and all of the shows and the atmosphere is the same. You can go to Germany, Spain, fucking all these different countries and cities, but the night is the same every show. Every night you're going to maybe hear the same record. You're going to hear a lot of Primo. You're going to hear a lot of Dilla. You're going to hear a lot of 90s. They're not playing a lot of the 2000 hip-hop. They do, but the majority of the night is 90s shit. And when they get into the 2000s, there's a lot of, like, of the underground shit we know. Like, you know, they'll play there's a lot of Dilla. There's a lot of Detroit, a lot of West Coast. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it varies, you know, where you go. Like, in Japan, they like a lot of West Coast hip-hop. They really do. Because the West Coast is right there. To them, hip-hop-wise, as far as you're talking about with the East Coast, is Europe. They like a lot of East Coast music, so it's crazy, but it's true and it's different. But hip hop is everywhere. As you can get to it and get out there, these people will come. But you just have to be active enough to, you know. And I tell a lot of artists, when you go to do these shows, no matter where you at, you know, be yourself, be genuine to these people, you know, because these promoters, some of them may not speak English, but they speak slang like we do in their language. And they would, you know, okay, where are you going to play me out? You're not coming back.
Yeah.
You know, and so we take pride in all of these shows.
Definitely. And from that time of traveling the world, you know, you know, many times over, L. How important is it to for artists today, you know, because some, you know, you all come from that golden age, you know, the, you know, what is regarded as the second golden age of hip-hop. Of course, the first golden age is considered 87, 88. And then, of course, you know, you could put 93 in there. 93, 94, 95 is considered that second golden age.
Yeah,
I mean, so how, from coming in that era, how important was it? Because especially from King and myself, you know, that's really one of the glory years for us in terms of really seeing it. You know, Rap City, Yo MTV Raps, you know, Video Bomb. You know, how important is it for artists today, these younger artists coming in the game today, to understand what you all knew back then about connecting with your audience, you know, meeting the fans, kissing the babies, all that good shit. You know, just meeting people and all that.
Well, these cats today don't really care about meeting nobody. They really care about getting their bread. You know, it's more, you know, up close with these cats when they online. You know, whereas when these, you know, dudes get to them in person, they not, you know, taking pictures with the cats like that, you know, unless they real nice about it. You know, I would say that for me, this doing this shit is a privilege, you know, and you should be really happy that somebody even want to take a picture with your ass, let alone buy your music and respect you and tell you how much they like you. You know what I'm saying? Like, when we doing this, man, these people are having life moments as being fans where they praying that you're not an asshole. That they
right.
Like, you know, a lot of cats come up to me and they just like, yo, can I take a picture with you? I'm like, are you asking me a question like that? Like, dude, like, come here. I grab them up. Like, you don't know what's going to happen to me tomorrow. Like, if today this is your time to say what you got to say. If you pissed off at me, say it. If some shit you ain't like that I did musically, say it. This is the time that you're going to get, you know, say your piece and take your picture and have your moment. Because the one thing you don't want is, you know, for you to have a bad moment with people that buy your music. I really take that seriously with, you know, online, with especially on Instagram, with, you know, being a merchant. You know, you have to be nice. You know, it's cats that'll come at you sideways because they're on there and they can talk to you like, hey, man, look, hey, I'm still me. You still you. Don't mean because we on here, you can talk to me any kind of way. You know what I'm saying? I'll respect you as long as you respect me. And, you know, I'm real nice about doing a lot of these things because it's about these fans. It's really about that because we ain't shit without them. I really believe that.
And, you know,
I think young cats, younger cats can take a note where, you know, don't take these people for granted. You know, you got a lot of people taking these fans for granted, whether it's, you know, merch, you know, sending stuff out on time. A lot of people don't get a lot of stuff. It'd be waiting months. You know, and then when you meet them, it's like, oh, you know, it's not the same as back in the day where you talking about, you know, a lot of these people was approachable. A lot of these artists was approachable where you see them somewhere, you wouldn't be so afraid. Like some bodyguard dude gonna smack you up. Nah, he ain't taking pictures right now. You know what I mean? It's different. So, you know, with this internet, makes it easier to communicate, but it's also a gift and a curse. Because people don't realize when you see a motherfucker in person, some they might be nice to you, some dude won't even give you the time of day.
You know, and you're so right on that. And one thing about this, L, that we're so privileged, you know, King started this, you know, whole movement 7 years ago. I've been part of it for the past four, and we've been so honored and privileged, you know, to talk to legends like yourself. Because part of this show and us being representatives of the culture and, you know, taking it upon ourselves to be curators in honorable fashion is to recognize legends like yourself, you know, while you're here. You know, we don't want a situation where you're gone and everybody's reminiscing. Like, no, we want to give you flowers now to let you know what you have done in terms of contributing to the great memories of our nostalgia and really laying the foundation down, putting culture forward. One thing that you have, how do you feel like music has been marketed, of course, because you all came up in the days of Stretch and Bobbito, you know, of course you mentioned about KRS-One doing the write-up. What have you seen now in terms of how music was marketed in terms of, you know, like when yourself you know, when you and Tame started, and where we see artists now. What is the process in terms of A&R, you know, vetting, you know, going through the business, everything, making sure these artists are ready to come out and drop a dope product? How have you seen a change over the years?
That shit you just said don't exist no more. Ain't no more, ain't no more A&R, ain't no more grooming artists, ain't no more teaching them, showing they like how they was back in Motown days, you know what I'm saying, grooming, you know, make sure you come out clean, dressed and pressed up. You see what the hell going on right now. These dudes got shit all over their face. They wearing guys wearing girl clothes.
Yeah.
Girls wearing guy clothes. You know what I'm saying? That's nothing. I don't just nothing. But it's just, I say, like, we living in bizarre world, period. It's not, I don't care if it's hip-hop or just life. We living in the times where all the shit we thought was corny when we was younger is the shit today. I'm like, huh? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's nothing of the sort, bro. It's no big bro. There's no Uncle Joe something over there like, you know, that, like, yo, come here. Like, that shit you doing is whack. Like, you know, so a lot of these kids is making records their parents didn't teach them about. Like, the most these kids can learn today is by watching Hip Hop Evolution on Netflix. Is by watching all these Biggie documentaries, Tupac documentaries. That's the most they learn because, you know, when I had, we had a 50 Cent son was on a panel with us. I'm just being this quick. We was on a panel. And he said something like, you know, he don't understand how the older cats are so hard on the MCs today. And far as in just how they rhyme. And, you know, he was so, like, he's like, yo, it's like a law, a rule book or something like that. Yo, we all the older dudes in the room was like, yes, there is the rules. There is laws to all this shit. So understand, and we had to really explain to him why we felt like the way we do, when he said it that way. It's like because, you know, and I said it, you know, we older dudes are partly to blame because we didn't have the time to sit back with y'all to say, like, you know, or y'all don't want to have the time for us. It was like that for Melly Mel and a lot of old school artists when their transition happened for them too. When you got LL coming in and Big Daddy Kane coming in, all these different groups, artists coming in, and it was like, wow, you know what I'm saying? These dudes are totally different from how we were spitting. So it was a transition. So
where
you
do
know,
you think the business
is? It's hard for, you know, dudes to understand that the torch going to get passed, but you also have to look at, like, how to react to that. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, with the way records are made today, you don't, there's no A&R to sit in the studio with you to say, you know, maybe I should try something else. You know, who's in the room saying that now? Even with a whole bunch of dudes you may know, they all going to agree. Yo, this shit hot, knowing it's not good.
Right.
You know,
they're
right. taking a ride. So that time period of, you know, that process of having a formula of, you know, like when EPMD was making records, they had every record was a formula. It was something that had to do with business, with the name. It was, you know, things that you could do to stand out. And all these dudes look the same, sound the same. I try to listen to the radio, man. I try to do it, yo. And I was like, we give these little niggas a chance. When I heard it, I was like, what are y'all talking about? I was like, I don't understand it. I don't understand the words. I'm not hating. I just really tried, man. I was like, you know, this is what's wrong. You know, nobody to tell these cats. And they don't want to hear it, though, because, like, you know, they're making bread. Like, nigga, get yourself, old man, get off my lawn, out of here. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're going to think we hating. But we just telling them, like, yo, there's a certain way y'all can do this shit and still make y'all bread. You know, you look at guys like J. Cole and Kendrick, they the only ones, only two mainstream dudes I can look at that look like they really even care about some music. But everybody's music sounds so depressing a little bit now, too. These cats, you know, they talk about dying and jumping off buildings and friends being on drugs. I'm like, what is happening?
OD.
There's no fun. There's no fun in this shit no more. So these guys is like young dudes thinking they old, taking drugs, you know, more than just smoking weed. You know, I'm just like, yo, man, y'all. And they don't realize this shit they doing is destroying them. You know what I'm saying? They think they partying. Like, yo, that what you doing right there? That's like, you're a dope head. That's what you drinking. And you just don't realize it. And then you out here, you know, on the street, and y'all music sound like how y'all look. And it's not the same. It's not the same how the process was for us. We was in the studio having fun. Our fun then was making dope-ass music in the studio smoking bunch of damn weed. Now today, you got to be drink. There's got to be bottles on the table and this, that, and the third. I'm like, oh, man. You know, the process, as how I'm saying, you can tell, is twisted now. Whereas, like, that's how I express it, and because it's what I see. And it's not the same as we were coming up. It's, like I said, there's no fun in this shit no more. No fun league.
Same when it came, it started becoming more corporate.
Shit, it was more corporate when Jay-Z and them started doing what they were doing. This shit now is everybody in it. Everybody can win. If you either do something crazy, say something crazy, you know what I'm saying? The traditional way, it still wins, but it ain't winning as big as these little dudes doing what they doing. You know what I'm saying? So it, the corporate, what we was doing was like what Jay and them did. Get a label. Get a group. Manage artists. Put artists out. You know, last person to do shit like that was 50 Cent. With G-Unit,
yeah,
and all
yeah.
that shit like that. That was his mind frame. But he was thinking like I was back in the day.
But it's wild, L, because when you look at it, you know, back in the day, hip-hop was a very exclusive fraternity in terms of rhyming. Like, just for your own self-respect, you know, you weren't getting on the microphone, let alone shooting a video, unless you knew you were ready. And, you know, the streets, you know, shout out to Uncle Rich, you know, Richie Rich in the Bay Area.
He's one of the most solid ones we had. I think T-Mass, he got his phone.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm right here.
Oh, you good.
Yeah, I'm here. But like Richie Rich was saying, though, you know, like Uncle Rich was telling, you know, it's like, you know, back in your hood, you know, they weren't even letting you get in the studio until they knew you were ready to
Word.
Do it.
Like, who this dude?
You know?
He nice? Like,
yeah.
He can't get on the mic. Get him off.
Yeah, it's like, look, you're trying to carry it for tradition in the hood. So it's like, you know, you representing the town, you know what I mean? So it's like, you putting it down, so they not letting you in unless they know for sure that you got it. You know, but, you know, with social media.
Yeah, that's what I say
these
days, man, you know, you got a little couple of views, you know, everybody follow you for a minute, and they blow you up, and then it could be over like that. These guys ain't thinking longevity. Hey, let me get what I can get now, you know, and half of them don't even make it to see most of these stuff because you're rubbed out by these other dudes.
Yeah, I think it's going to transform all because everybody look at the now mentality because, you know, they look at the now mentality, it's easier to get on. When you build in the future, it takes
yeah,
long
it ain't, you're not going to a person to say, give me a deal. You're not going to a label no more. It's no more of that. You know what I'm saying? It's like you really just do the shit in your room. And, you know, it's just that's the gullible part of all of this. You know, the same reason why Trump became president is because you got all these following cats and they, you know, half these dudes shouldn't be making records. You know, the market is so flooded. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah,
there's people that's out there that know what to buy. If you know what kind of hip-hop you like, there's people out there that it's... This shit is so blown up, wide open for everybody to do your thing. It's just crazy for me doing it now where it works. And I'm at the age I'm at. You wish these tools was able to be used in the past, too. You know, so it's like, I love it. But the game is very oversaturated. You know what I'm saying? I really don't even look at it like that too much no more. And this point in my career, when people ask me, like, what you feel about the state of hip-hop, and I tell them I don't. I don't think about it. Like when I listen to the radio, I'm like, it's not the same fight anymore. When you talk about what we was going up against when we was making records. You know what I'm saying? When you heard songs like Cypress Hill, you want to be a rap superstar, who we all, these songs were made because it was a system we were going up against that was keeping those good records from being made. You know, these certain groups that we love was getting moved to the side for the part of where the money came into play. Once the record industry saw the money part where they can make from, you know, that's why you remember the independent priority, you know what I'm saying? A lot of independent record labels,
you know, Tough City,
started disappearing.
You know, Ethan Bag Records.
They started they started disappearing because they weren't producing money for these bigger imprinted labels. So you look at it now, it's only Warner Brothers. It's only like maybe RCA. There's no more labels like it used to be. So that's why with the way this shit is, you can have a camera on your phone, shoot a video. You could do this without a motherfucker. You can be in your room, Pro Tools. Be in your room with your man, make a beat. Do this. You do everything all by yourself. And that's the part that's, you know, the where, you know, if you know you ain't dope like that, you get, it's easy to tell somebody, yo, don't do that, but you can't tell people not to do that today. When it's at their disposal, where they got somebody to go to say, can you give me a demo? Shit, remember them days? That was our days. Can you give me this deal so I can put this record out?
Yeah. And, you know, it's wild, you know, because, you know, back in the day, you know, it was really a process in terms of, like, you know, like you really had to go through hoops, you know, of course, social media for the accessibility and the efficiency of which it could be executed to get on, you know, that was not even thought of. I mean, dude, can you imagine?
And that's because it costed money. And I'm saying,
right,
let's even go
right,
back to what my man said. Like,
video. Yeah.
I mean, like, we talking about the only way you was promoting your shit was in magazines. So you talking about the source, you spend the money, $2,500. Rap pages, you talk about rap sheet, you talking about vibe, you know what I'm saying? And that was with the labels. These are where the things of the label had came into play. Because once you make that record, you ain't doing that as an artist. Where you getting the bread? You don't even know how to do it. You make a video, you can make your own video back then and have paid for it and everything. Give it to the label. They're not servicing it because they had nothing to do with it. Like, how does it look? What's going on? We used to be like, what if we shot a video? I used to ask crazy questions. What if we shot a video for such and such song? And they would say, well, we're not going to put it to the record, I mean, the video people. I'm like, why not? Because they ain't had nothing to do with it. That's why. And it wasn't no decision made from the big head. We're going to send this out as the single, and they're going to promote it. You know, that's when I started learning shit, like you say. And what part did I learn? Being in the game, that part, being, I used to come in Atlantic office and sit at people's desk. I see my name on shit. I see artifacts. What's that? What's this? Mm-hmm. What's that? My name on there. Let me see. Nigga, they would tell me. This is that. Word. I'm like, you know what I'm saying? And that's the part that I was like, you know, once I started learning and knowing who was who, doing what, and it was people getting fired when we were doing stuff, and then like, they hired somebody else. I'm like, damn, we got to start all over. This nigga don't know what's going on with that. And it was crazy. So when I saw that part of the game and knowing that none of these people cared about what we were doing in the sense of where they, like, you can go to all those meetings that we went to and this guy's in charge of publicity, he's in charge of marketing, and I'm looking at them like, you don't care, you don't even live with anywhere close to where we live at or know what kind of hip-hop we're doing for y'all to even work this shit. So that's where I was learning things to say, well, let me at least be in here so I can explain to them or whatever, even with I know probably wouldn't fly. I just tried it. But that's how I learned. It was like, this the part of the game I don't like. I love being on stage. And for the record, you know, even for years after we was off Atlantic, there's no manager for Artifacts. There's no booking agent. I mean, we have booking agent friends that we work with, but this is all run by us, me and Tame. You know what I'm saying? I'm the point man, but we do everything on our own. There's no magic guy behind the carpet. I mean, behind the curtains, doing none of this stuff for us. So everything y'all see online, anything y'all see me doing on my own solo, is all me and Tame. That's it.
You started seeing that shift around the time you guys were working on the That's Them album.
I saw that, you know, what the difference was in the first album energy wise and the second one, it was definitely different. You know what I'm saying? Because Atlantic moved to a bigger building, they had different people working. You know what I'm saying? It was like from the first album, definitely not the same people working at the label. So it just became a little bit, like you said, more corporate to a level of people not knowing what the hell they was doing, not being from where we from, not being from the culture, not being from, you know, a time where to know how to push the record. It would act like they didn't know what our crowd was. When we had the most write-ups, the most everything in the office, when you go in the drawer to see everybody's, like, you know, marketing and stuff. So, you know, once I saw that, I was like, all right, you know, even when we got off the label, I said, let me do what I learned and apply it to me and Tame and not even go back to the mainstream and try to get another deal like that. I was like, fuck, and it took me and Tame to go solo to do that. You know, and it wasn't no breakup thing where we was fighting or nothing like that. It wasn't about no bread. We were just burnt out trying to keep up with a big-ass machine like that where we knew they wasn't able to do for us.
Definitely. Now, what did you find, L, when you went on the solo tip from the context of, you know, not having that pressure of a big label in terms of giving demands and making all these, you know, orders in terms of what y'all had to do? What did you find on the underground movement of independence that really, really was the beauty of it for you?
Shit, first of all, they ain't never tell us what to do. We did everything. Gotcha. Everything you heard us do was what we wanted to do. And for the record, that Brick City Kids record, we only called ourselves Brick City. We were the first group to do a record on, and that was Ruckus' first single ever. Not Most Def and Quali, nothing like that. It was Brick City Kids, Artifacts, produced by VIC and Juju. And we put that record out with them, and we're still signed to Atlantic. So we knew how to even finagle that without getting in trouble. But that they never told us what to do. All the shit y'all heard that ever came out, because we just did it. Like, when we did the second album, my man Reef, I love him, but we even kept him out the studio the first couple of weeks because we just wanted to make the shit we wanted to make. All the shit we saw in J Period, we was locking the studio up. We was locked. All the with Baby Fall, locked the studio up. And only when we did Ultimate, my man Reef came to the studio, and he actually was listening to the song. We missing something in the song because he kept listening to the hook. And he ran home, not Uber, not he jumped on the train, went back uptown from downtown, and went up to 102nd Street to his crib, brought the record back, and was like, we need this. And he just put that shit on the side. Ultimate, just for that. Wasn't no looking online for that shit. He had to go all the way back to the uptown, go get the Ultimate 3MC's record, and bring back to the studio just to loop that. Ultimate, we could have said that. Nope, no, we're getting the record. Because people knew, and even Red Alert, when he used to play it, when he heard that record, he played that so much on the radio. He said, I got to say, this one of my favorite records. Y'all actually, I know these guys, Ultimate 3MCs, and he felt so good that we put that sample in there. He said he would have never thought nobody would have did that again or even just did that, thought of it. And I was happy about it. We made him happy. But, yeah, them, you know, we had fun doing those records.
You know, and it's a testament to what y'all did, because when you listen to the records, when you listen to both of them, it still stands the test of time. It doesn't sound dated. It doesn't sound, you know, like it's still it's fresh. It's still relevant today.
But those records, when you listen to anything, me and even mostly my stuff, but when you listen to me and Tame's records, even solo, they come from the Artifacts formula. So, you know, to even answer your question, the difference for me doing it solo, like, you know, it's the only drawback from doing it by myself is more to this. You know what I'm saying? When you used to have a partner, like, it was hard. It was a hard thing to do solo-wise in the beginning. Because even with my first single solo-wise was Frontline with Pharoah Monch and FT, Prince Poe, Mike Zoot. I was still doing a group thing, but the B side was just me by myself. So I'm like, you know, the more records I did, you know, I had to write more. So I was like, damn, you know, and scaringly not knowing if people wanted to hear me by myself. So that was the one thing I could say, like, that was for me having so much freedom. I knew that I had to say more. And, you know, people used to hearing me and Tame going back and forth, like, how they going to feel with just me by myself. So I had to still do records like as if me and Tame was in the room, and even still today, I think of that in myself to do it and to accomplish the job, but I know I have to do it alone. But inside, in my bubble, in my mind, I'm like, think what you know and get these people to latch on just as much as I want people to latch on to me by myself and the style that I'll bring alone.
Right. And, you know, it's just something to say because, you know, you've been doing this at a high level for so many years. You know, me and King, you know, we've had so many guests on our show, you know, and we talked about how hip-hop seems to be the only genre at times where it tries to force, you know, the legends out. Like, there's some type of, you know, standard in terms of age where there's, where heads say, well, you can't do it no more. My thing is bull fucking shit. You know, I'm like,
word up.
You know, niggas
got
like, yeah, niggas got a right to do this. I'm like, Jay-Z, 51, you know, still doing it. Nas is, what, 45, 46, still doing it. You know,
look at Master Ace. Ace putting out quality records at it. I mean, it's not about age. It's about your skill. It's about your skill level.
Yeah, you know, Busta, you know, just, you know, last year dropped one of the bangingest albums.
Man, that nigga dropped the dopest album in 2 years. Cause, and, you know, but you know why? Because he stuck to his formula. Why go away from that? You know what I'm saying? When you hear them songs, but he knows, and this is my way, this is what I call it. He still got to make his little nigga records. When you listen to the album, he got all them records for us. But then you still can look in there, he got this little nigga record right here for these little dudes that make these kind of beats. And, you know, all that, he got the little, you know, he's still talking like, you know, he got to talk for them, but he's still spitting like for us. So we appreciate it more because we understand, like, you know what, Buzz, you're going to make all them little nigga records because that's what you do in all your records anyway. But it's just today, right, little dude records. But the majority of that record was songs that he could have been on any of those albums that he, prior to that last one, even the ones on Aftermath.
Yeah,
so,
you know
I hear what you're saying. Like, for me, I do this shit the same way I did it when me and Tam got in, to compete and to show people that, you know, I don't even think people look at my age so much unless they hear me say it, or if they look at, you know, how many records we've done, or, you know, look at the first couple of albums, because, like you said, I've been making records solo since 99, and every year, maybe it was 1 year I probably didn't put out a record or something. But I say that to say every year up to this year, I put out a record every year since 1999. If not on my own shit, mm-hmm. somebody else's record or a feature, a guest appearance, whatever, you know, like you said, at a high level to where still, until my phone stopped ringing and my email stopped, slow down with the features, I'm going to keep going because the phone calls come. And they only doing that because of what they hear, what we sound like. And that's that's just wanting to be a part of this shit. You know, I equate everything to sports. So when you look at Vince Carter, when he was playing as long as you, like, yeah, you got to play no more. But Vince Carter, like, fuck that. I can still yam on that little dude right there. And I can still shoot this two-pointer right here. I probably can't sky on your ass like I used to do when I was younger, but I can still play, and I still think I can contribute for a team, and, you know, why not? Because I feel like I can. So, and when I'm ready, and he stopped when he felt like it. You know, nobody told him to sit his ass down. You old. Why you still playing? Come be an analyst. Nope. I still think I can give to some team. So, for me, I'm feeling like, you know, as long as I keep my body intact, keep my voice together, and I, you know, a lot of times people ask, like, how do you, you know, what's your key to longevity? Man, you better work with these little motherfuckers that everybody working with today. You know, my key to that was, like, even when I did Crowd Pleaser, I worked with Illmind. I didn't know Illmind was going to blow up to be the dude he is now. But I knew, listening to them beats he played me, and I was like, damn, who this dude? And I got that 2 CDs. I heard that Crowd Pleaser shit, and I was like, I called him instantly. I said, yo, did you get that beat away yet? He said, nah. I said, that's mine. and for me, that record, I can say this right now on the radio, that is my solo hit record. That Crowd Pleaser, no matter where I do that record at, I could be in Russia. I've been there, so they know it too, but I've been everywhere, and that shit come on, and I'm surprised every time, because I've been to Poland where this dude was screaming for another artist to come on, and I just interrupted my show. I was like, my man, look, check this out. Of all the songs, and I told him, put the spotlight on him in the crowd. It's like 700 people in there. I said, yo, put the spotlight on him. I said, yo, my man, look at me. I said, I guarantee you that of all the songs that I'll do tonight, this one right here that's about to come on, I guarantee you, hey, I'm looking at you. I guarantee you, this one you gonna like. He looked at me, yo, my man had his arms folded. He's like, we gonna see. That beat came on. Yo, everybody in the crowd lost it. They lost it. He's standing there still with his arms a little folded. I say, I'm looking at him like, yeah, I look, my whole first verse, I'm looking at him. I'm talking to him in the beat like, yeah, I see you. Watch, watch, first verse, here we go. And everybody in the crowd is looking at him. Still got the spotlight on my man. And I'm talking to him in the crowd, pointing to him and everything. And he's, and look, that motherfucker started cracking a smile. He's like, he's in the crowd and smiling, he laughing. He got, he put his hand down. He started shaking his head like, ah, you got me. I was, ah, see, there we go. So the rest of the show, he was cool. And even when out in the crowd, I spoke to him. He's like, my bad, I was yelling. I said, don't worry about it. I ain't home, but I, that's my job. I had to impress you enough to, even with that one song, you got into it. So that's really what this shit is about. You know what I'm saying? And that, that song does it for me everywhere, and it's because of that damn track. And there's just something about that song, man. You know, I know that, you know, that's the song that people know me for by myself.
You know, and you know, L, that's such a blessing because, you know, that's your championship among many, you know, because, you know, you have, and, you know, King and myself, you know, we always talk about signature songs with artists, you know, and some have a whole lot, you know, and some have that one particular song, you know, that really, 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 you know, when you think of Ice Cube, you could think of It Was a Good Day. You could think of America's right. Most Wanted. You could think of No Vaseline. If you think of Nas, you could say It Ain't Hard to Tell, you know, Street Dreams, you know, Jay-Z, you know, Dead President, you know, Hard Knock Life. I mean, you were crowd pleaser. I mean, Biggie, you know, rest in peace. You know, Gimme the Loot, you know, Big Papa, you know, Juicy. It's like, what is it like to have a song that you know, and just in your work in general, that reaches the audience in such a capacity that they really, really like, you have actually, that you've just really like brightened their whole existence with what you injected into them with, you know, that, you know, the rhyme imagination. What type of gratification does that give you as a performer, the satisfaction of the artist, and just the enjoyment as a human being, but knowing people really enjoy what you do?
Well, this part of the job, I always tell people, is the hardest, because you never know what people are going to like that you do. So you kind of consciously have to go into doing this knowing that you got to bring a certain style and flair to the song, to the listener that follows you, you know, to the person that don't know you. So you have to take into consideration all that, but you always have to, for me, I always go in the studio thinking that nobody know me. You know, this
right.
This is the first song I'm ever going to try to do, and try to be and think as hard as I can, not say the same thing I said before, change this flow, do this, do that, because we are like how we, you know, like I say, like, go back to sports. As kids, we like football teams, and if you a certain guy and you a certain build, you're going to like, if you like to catch the ball, you're going to like wide receivers. So if you look at
right.
certain teams of me growing up, lyrically, I look at myself like that. So it's like trying to be agile. You're trying to be lyrically in a way to be like how Jerry Rice, when he played, my team was the 49ers, he never liked to get dirty. You ain't tackling me. I'm that nice. You're not going to put me on the ground. My everything's going to be clean. My towel's going to be white. But I'm going to do my thing the whole game.
Right.
On you. So it's like people expect that out of this person. I expected that from him when he got on the field. Just as much as when people hear Artifact's name and when they think of our music, when they think of something new, and they know something coming out, they would hope to think that, all right, this shit going to have bass lines, it's going to have scratching, these dudes going to be going back and forth, it's going to be crazy, they're going to, you know, it's time for excitement, you know what I'm saying? And it's something that we know that if we don't bring that, we're underwhelming the listener, because we started with that, so the bar is extra high, and that comes from wanting to be great. As far as like amongst all the other people we listened to that we thought was like that, we want the same effect too. So you go into this in the mind state of like you want to come out of it knowing that the person that bought your record is like taking on a trip to where they're like, damn, you know, I didn't expect that, but you bought it to expect what? You know what I'm saying? It's like you bought it, you know, for us to, like, you know, go in there and give you what you want. You know what I'm saying? It's a certain thing that people get out of what we listen to, out of what you buy and listen to, just the same as us being consumers, me as a listener. I know what I want, and you go to the certain artists that give you what you want. And, you know, sometimes when you conscious of that as an artist, you're going to know, like, writers that make books, Stephen King, writers that, you know, Tom Clancy with this damn movie with Michael B. Jordan. We know Tom Clancy as video games in your head, but you just do write books to make these video games. So when you go play the game, you expect this shit that they write in the book. So when
right.
we write in these rhymes, when we write in these rhymes, people believe what we say. And when we say we, that's why I say Wrong Side is that song for me and Tame. You know what I'm saying? I've been with the hardest of the hardest dude in front of me. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? This dude look like he's going to whoop my ass, but they come out like, yo, man, I grew up listening to y'all and that damn graffiti, that's that Wrong Side, man. We used to go painting, playing there. That's what we hear the most from everybody. You know what I'm saying? Like that song influenced them to write or influenced them to write again or, you know, so it's like to make something, that was what, with that song. And, you know, Lil Jamar made us write that song. Lil Jamar did the original version of Wrong Side of the Tracks. We couldn't use the version because it was a James Brown sample, but the version you hear today was what we did with T-Ray. The hook I'm saying, Lil Jamar wrote that hook, said that hook. If you want to hear it, you can go on YouTube right now and put in Artifacts Wrong Side Demo, and you'll see and you'll hear Lil Jamar doing the hook and me and Tame doing the same vocals that you hear on the Wrong Side version that you got on your vinyl. But, you know, Jamar asked us, like, well, what are y'all about? Like, we did that song in Sadat X basement when we was, you know, first with them in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, like, what y'all do is about, you know, because they would kind of say, like you said, grooming us, but we wasn't asking them to put us out or nothing like that. We just was cool with them. And when we did that song was when they first heard us spit, where they was like, oh, shit. Like, you know, they sounded like that. You know, Jamar was like, yo, if y'all do graffiti, like, talk about that. Talk about being a B-boy. We wrote all that shit right there in front of him, and we, you know, and it came out the way it did. We just had to change the beat. But, you know, we know that that song is what we, is our claim to fame. If we get old and they ask us to come out to do some hip-hop greatest hits, and we 60 years old or some shit like that, yeah, we're doing Wrong Side. And we doing Come On to Get Down.
But, you know, and one thing about it, L, this wild, man, because, and I always reference this, it was an interview, shout out to Torrey, one half of the Barrel Brothers with Kaz,
also
did a tremendous album with Illmind as well. You know, we got to always bring them 6 degrees and take it down
and
to
Marco
three.
Polo.
Yeah, Marco Polo, yeah, man. You know, something about Canada, just how they bring out the dopest producers and artists, too. But, you know, Torrey said in an interview one time about, you know, no, it was Fonte, because Torrey was doing an interview about how he, you know, he just, you know, because he had a job as a banker and how he left to just do what he loved. It was Fonte I'm thinking of, you know, of course, the little brother who was talking about in terms of the music that you want to have that has long. Yeah, you want to have longevity. He's like, you want to be able to do music when you're in your 20s. That you won't be ashamed of listening to in your 30s, you know. And when we think of, you know, like, you know, you and Tame, when we think about Raekwon, we think about Ghostface, Jay-Z, you know, Nas, Busta, you know, Redman, you know, Method Man, you know, MCA, Ice Cube, you know, they can all do songs, you know, Brother Cam, you know, Richie Rich, they can all do songs from their back catalog that is still going to sound fresh and relevant today because it defined culture in terms of what it really, really, really set. It set the bar. It raised the standard, you know, for what
it captured, you know, it's like all of these songs are like time capsules in our life.
Exactly.
When we think about them, we can go to YouTube and have that feeling. You know, I listen to a lot of old songs, a lot of old R&B. You know, when I play it for my people, whatever, if we just listen and chilling, whatever, they like, yeah, they all talk about what they were doing when they heard the songs. You know, what that song or what the song did for them, that they still get out of it today. You know, whether they get you out of a sad state or is it make you happy or just some shit you got to get off your chest. A lot of songs are made for these moments for yourself in your life where you feel like you're in a mood. These are why you fans of these artists and songs. Whether if it's Onyx, you want to get into a rowdy mood, you're going to play that. You're going to play Wu-Tang. You're going to play, you know, a lot of things that can set your mood, but that's that's what it's supposed to do for you. And you being a responsible artist, you know, and you know how to craft your music to the crowd that you listen to. I mean, that listen to you, rather.
Yeah, and, you know, listening to, you know, when we think about that era, man, we reflect on it so fondly because, you know, this is before social media, you know, L, this is before everything just became so convoluted, you know. And the one thing I really, really, really loved growing up, you know, I'm 43 years old, you know, one thing I loved growing up was that back in the day before, which to me the whole West Coast, East Coast thing was just really a big misunderstanding that unfortunately spiraled out of control. But when you think about it, when we look at Rap City and the Video Music Box and MTV OVT Rap, one thing I really loved about the marketing in terms of it, I started reading Source Magazine in 1994, so that's when I really, you know, got into it deeper because I was always into hip-hop, but to seriously get into it, that was in the, you know, around 93, 94. But when you read the magazines, when you looked at the videos, shows, there was no division. You know, it was, even with the radio back in the day, you know, I remember, you know, I'm out here in Hampton Roads, Virginia. I remember 1993 when our local radio station dropped Threats, Let the Dogs Loose, and we were like, I mean, and I was like,
they don't know nothing about that.
Yeah.
The reaction when you hear a big record drop, they don't know the generation knows nothing about this because everything is so instant.
Yeah. I mean, and especially doing videos, man. I mean, back in the day, you know how it was. I mean, when you had these collaborations and videos, like when you had guest star pop-ups, like when Jodeci did that Love You for Life video and they had T-Bars in it, you know, when
you had
the Bomb video with Akin Yelly and you had Kool G Rap in it, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, when you had a threat, you know, Deadly Threat, because, of course, he was down with Ice Cube. When you had Ice Cube in the camera, I mean, it was like, it was exciting, man. Like King said, like, it really meant something. You know, it was just the era, the nostalgia of it is just something that you get choked up thinking about because you realize with the culture of one time how open it was, how non-biased it was, how bi-coastal it was, where we could appreciate each other's shit from both sides of the of the country. in terms of where you see hip hop today, do you think it's become segregated in terms of coast, or do you kind of see a bit of an opening up once again to where people coming from different spots and everybody all over is like really rocking for people from different areas?
I mean, I still think it's what people like, you know, going to what you said. We used to, us being from Jersey, like we couldn't go to New York and go over there and do shows and be like, you know, on stage. Before we start, like, yo, we from Jersey, we would just go out there and do our thing and be like, hey, we're going back to Jersey. What? Jersey? Something like that. So, you know, it was like when we would go out of town, like I said, for me, the biggest thing was going to Cali, man, you don't know if these people going to accept you being from where we from, not even thinking about none of that East Coast, West Coast shit, just you being from where you from. Knowing there's other MCs in these areas. And these people from every radio station all over was, you know, mostly colleges was asking us to come. We went to all of the ones we could go to. But they booked us there because of who we were and what we represented in our music because they were like us. All these radio station DJs was like me and Tame. All still to this day, all the promoters are like us. It's older promoters, younger promoters, male, female, but they're like us. And they know what we're bringing to the table, so that's why they book us. So it's like the era of where we come from was because we was an act. You know what I'm saying? Today, these cats don't know that feeling of going to other places like we did. And honestly, when we was going, I'm going before we was in Chicago, we was in L.A., we was in New York, we was in down south, Florida, whatever, where we were performing for the crowd, the radio people, the L.A. people to show who we were. Today, you don't have to do that because there are no radio shows and it's just stuff like what we're doing right now. And these guys don't go through the ranks of knowing that if somebody going to tell you, your shit sucks. And you shouldn't do that. You know what I'm saying? Like, but it's like majority of the places that you see these people go because they have a record out. It's a process. Like I said, we did all of that. Retail run, radio run. We will be with other artists, you know what I'm saying? We just do the retail runs with them because we on the same, you know, label thing. You know, back then, that's what it was. Warner Atlantic. Electric, you know what I'm saying? So this process is no more. So you have to make the process. A lot of these cats just do online. They don't realize, you know what I'm saying, is ways to market yourself. You pay somebody, an online marketing company, to send your shit to the blog, make sure that they get your music. These dudes don't want to spend no money. They'd rather spend money on, you know, the presentation of getting in a banner and letting flashing online, but you know, there's other ways you can do that where it's not gonna cost you a lot of money. It can cost you like $400 to send somebody your video, a blog company, a media company, your music, a video, and they'll service it for a couple of weeks, but everybody will see it. But if your music is what you feel it is and you thinking it works, you compete in the hip hop DX, you compete in you know, a lot of these blog sites, you know, a lot of them different now. Compared to when, you know, as many as it was before, but there's a lot of media markets out there and sites. One particular Diamond Media, my man Matt Diamond, Coal Mine Records, he services a label and a marketing tool for you to use, even if you're not on a label and you want to use his service. It's a freelance thing where you pay your bread and he sends it out further than what you would do on your own. But right. But this is for people that's serious. You know what I'm saying? As you know, you're putting out a record. You're not just, you know, putting out a video or putting out a song, posting it on Spotify. You're putting out a whole album. You're putting out a whole project. And I think people need to think about that more than just doing the one-time thing or one-off, one record. You know, do the whole album so you get shit out that still like what people want. They can take a song or two like that, but you still won't put out a whole album.
And it's wild, L, because we know King and myself, you know, King actually was a journalist that actually did stuff for Raucous and everything, writing reviews and getting the promos and helping to get the word out. You know,
Yes, sir.
And one thing about it, when you look at what was going on during that time, because a lot of artists, you know, and you know, my brother and myself, we always talk about this, you know, King, because we always talk about what the market was then and what it is now. You know, nowadays, the emphasis is always on social media fame or infamy, depending on who you are. And you're dealing with individuals that are really more concerned about just trying to go viral off stupid shit rather than substance. You know, and now even, if we really want to start, you know, kicking some, you know, can of worms over, you know, I mean, you got a lot of these niggas that's paying, you know, for these views, you know, in terms of like they're artificially inseminating those numbers to give birth to popularity. You know, we going to keep going. You know, the fact is that depending on where you are in certain hoods, you got guys like G Perico, shout out to Broadway Gangster. You know, G Perico has a real movement with So Way out in South Central, you know, with his clothing line and his music. He, like, really is bubbling, you know, and when you're dealing with places, especially like in the L.A. market, you know, of course, shout out to Mike Jones, you know, the old man, as we affectionately call him, Jay Prince, what he built with Rap-A-Lot. You know, they built their base in Houston. You know, Slim Thug, you know, K Reno, you know, Shingo Bling, all those guys. You know, look what's going on in Buffalo right now. You know, with a group, I think you may have heard of them. You know, Benny Conway and Westside, collectively known as
Griselda,
who I'm a big fan of. You know, and how they built their movement, and it was all by hard work and a dope product.
Brick by brick,
right,
layer
by
layer.
They're doing it the whole way with the product. I'm saying, like, pressing that
record.
And that showed people, like, oh, damn, they still want record. Yes, there's people out there, DJ-wise, that collect music, and it's proven the way they put their stuff out, you know, is exclusive.
And in turn, and that goes into my next question, L, about the merchandise, because, of course, you know, you branched off, of course, you know, what you all have with Artifacts Brand, some dope-ass gear, you know. Mm-hmm. And also want to ask you, too, from that perspective about the media in terms of, like, CDs and everything else. How do you feel about where some people try to say, because I still have my CDs and my cassettes and albums, and I'm not giving them away for jack shit, and all my Source and XXL magazines. I ain't giving none of that up. How do you feel about where some people say that the physical copies of albums are outdated and passe business model, and everybody wants to start streaming and everything? What is your feelings on that?
Well, I think they better look online and do some research. Because vinyl has gone up every percentage-wise over the last 10 years. And it has increased. Even right now, the reason why the Artifacts record ain't ready yet is because we're still pressing it up. And the demand is very high. So right now, you know, I think people need to believe in that a little bit more, because people still ask me if I got CDs coming from me and Sadat's album, the XL album. I'm like, nah, and a lot of people were disappointed. So we did the cassettes too. You know, a lot of people like to collect cassettes still and add it in the collection. But, you know, you don't have to order so many CDs. You can order 100, 200, but do everything. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, vinyl is never going to die. You know, all this sound has reached the ceiling, where a lot of these people that have been, you know, using all these machines and shit like that is now, you know, feel like, let me try something else. But the vinyl is something that won't go away, because they've seen, you know, a lot of people that have got rid of their records, you know, of course, because of the digital era, of course, you got to do that for your DJ. You don't have to carry all these records and shit around, but it's vinyl still being pressed up. And people would lose out if they didn't do that. Because even Jay-Z still press up albums, but even Taylor Swift, dumbass, make records.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's a situation, too. But I tell anybody, you know, King and myself, we always talk about, I'm like, we tell anybody, if you don't believe about the in terms of preserving culture with CDs and cassettes, I'm like, y'all need to go online and look at how much some of that stuff is in terms of what that stuff's going for. Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt, the cassette. And I'm going to indulge myself a little bit, dive in, because I need to throw out these numbers, because I got to let our listeners know exactly how much the inflation goes up in terms of the rarities of a lot of this stuff, because it's not available. I saw Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt cassette. Now, mind you, this was the second pressing, because they had, of course, the sample issue with the first one. That's why the record had to come off the shelf for a year. I saw on eBay a couple months ago that second press of the Reasonable Doubt cassette is going for roughly around maybe about $100. DJ Quick's Rosecrantz, and King knows this because I sent him the screenshot of it on Amazon, and it may have actually come down a little bit. It's already out of print in terms of the physical. That Rosecrantz CD, which was, well, the EP was going for like $975.
Damn.
Sauce Money's middle finger you waxed, I think that was going for maybe about $100. I have a cassette. I saw somebody selling their Banging on Wax, the Bloods and Crips album, the cassette rather, online for like $200. Somebody somebody was selling the original 1995.
The bigger one I've seen was Cam'ron's Public Enemy mixtape was $1,000.
$1,000?
Yeah.
$1,000.
My man burned it for me some years ago, so I got it. But yeah. But it is one year. That came out in 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my man's got that for me. He got that for me. What is it? I mean, we can keep going. I mean, with whatchamacallit, the original Cuban Links purple tape, the cassette, the 1995.
You guys crazy. They could go ahead and download that tip and still get it. It's still up here. Some of the songs.
Yeah, but I think the Cuban Links cassette is going for like, somebody was selling it online for like, I think, close to $10,000, the original press.
They ain't getting that.
I got the cassette on the gray. I got the gray because I didn't know, because I thought that was going to be part of the shtick of the album, that it was going to be like all the joints were going to be purple, but it turned out they only put out a limited run in purple. So I got the press. It's just in the clear cassette, but it's not in the purple one. You know, and Get On Down, you know, shout out to them. About 8 years ago, they did a marketing where they actually did a special marketing press run where they ended up pressing up like a set number. Like they had like different, like they had like the cassette by itself, the purple tape for like $20. I think if you wanted like the box set, it was like $400 or $500. And you know, just inflation, everything, the shit has gone way up now. I mean, even with some of the magazines now, you know, the 2009 XXL freshman issue with Nipsey, I think that was going for some crazy price.
Oh, you know that, why that went up. I understand now. Somebody asked me online if I had a Dynamite Soul vinyl, and I told him no. I said, why? I said, I'm looking for one myself. He said, well, I'm online right now, and I see this one they got in here for like $100. If you got it, I'll give it to you. Other shit, no, I ain't got it. I said, if I had it, I would definitely sell it to you, bro.
While we're on the subject of memorabilia in terms of CDs and cassettes and LPs, what was it like back in the day in terms of pressing up that merchandise, in terms of all of that? Did you all manage to get some of your hands on the merchandise that was pressed up specifically for y'all, or was that just shipped out once it was pressed up?
Now, as far as the artifact merch?
Yeah, like the promos, like the CDs, cassettes, CDs, albums,
anything,
all that.
The only thing that we had promo-wise that was dope was the markers. The artifact markers. And, from that day on, like, anything you saw merch-wise that were T-shirts and shit like that was what I did. You know, even up to this point now, like, my whole goal always was to, you know, I like that shit, promo stuff. You know, when I got the B-Nuts album, when they put their stuff out, I got a drumstick in a plastic bag with a T-shirt, but the drumstick was so dope because, you know, it had the B-Nuts logo on it in red, and you know, it made sense to me. You know, I've seen stuff, you know, where I was like, you know, we need to always have shirts. You know, and plus being on the road, a lot of people, you know, especially in Europe, you know, they ask me, like, yo, you ain't got no shirt? It was sometimes where I didn't have no merch. After a while, listen, let me bring my shit. I'm bringing CDs, I'm bringing tapes, I'm bringing T-shirts, you know, and now, you know, it's to the utmost to have it, you know, and then, you know, I'm, like, even right now, I'm doing pop-up shops all over the country. We're starting to set up where it's like, you know, because we can't do no shows, I'm outside at these record shops, vinyl shops or whatever, and, you know, I'd rather do it that way because at least if we have to go outside, we can do that, but it's something for the people. You know, they come through, you know, nothing is crazy expensive or nothing like that. So you come through to meet me. You know, we, you know, I take pictures with people. But it was always important to have merch because, you know, it's something to people can leave something from you as well. Because sometimes
right.
they buy the merch and ask you to sign it. I'm like, you sure you want me to sign the shirt, bro? You know what I'm saying? Like, I made the shirt for you. And they're like, nah, man, you know, dude, I'm like, all right, you paying for it is what you want. I don't mind. I write on the neck part and the inside. And nah, bro, I want it right on the front by the logo.
Yeah, because you know
what I'm saying?
Like,
it's on you, man.
They
be drunk and shit. I'm just writing the shit up, man. I'm not even going to wear it. I'm like, cool, because, you know, these are things that help in what you're doing. It helps promote the group. It helps promote the cause, you know, and I just want everybody in the world. I have a dream, an ongoing dream, that one day me and Tame going to do a show somewhere. And everybody in the crowd gonna have an Artifacts T-shirt, all different color shirts, hats, anything. But like, if you see anything with anybody wearing shit, it's only because they got it from me. There's no Alibaba, nobody on eBay selling nothing of with this logo. This all anybody. My man in Australia ordered something from me because he saw another person in Australia with an Artifacts hoodie on and took a picture of the lady. It was a lady. And she had the hoodie on, and it was army green. I said, yeah, they got that for me. He's like, bro, there's no one else walking around here with that on their back. Like, I need one. And it's, you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of Europeans buy stuff, but a lot of Australians buy stuff. And, you know, it's just crazy, man. I never thought that, you know, after 25 years, almost 30 years now, me and Tame putting out them first two albums, to have solo albums and solo careers, to get back together again, to be right back where we started. And it, like, we never left, even if we broke up for that little bit of time we did. We were still going.
And that's the blessing in it, man, because it shows the longevity and how at the end of the day, you know, you all are still going to come back together because you all are one of the You're living legends, both of you. We'll say it on the show, damn it, if nobody else does. For what you all
man,
contributed,
I appreciate it, dude. Thank you.
For that era, I don't want to become a sentimental sap getting choked up, but for what you brought to this kid from Hampton Roads, Virginia, who saw y'all do it, and, you know, the music that y'all brought, because I have I got to get that to them. But I do have, you know, y'all debut, and it's like, you know, but to listen to it, man, it's like, you know, it takes me back to such a happy place of really knowing what the hip-hop really, I think Nas's album, Illmatic, is a great. I'm not going to call it the greatest of all time because I believe hip-hop is too diverse. But I would put y'all album out there with Nas's Illmatic is just a true representation of hip-hop culture. I would put y'all on that level with Illmatic.
Thank you. That's big time right there. That is very big because when you think about all the albums that was made, even that I like personally, you know, it's hard to explain, but it's not. But it's just, you make records to hear shit like that. You know what I'm saying? Because as a fan, I've come to meet my peers that I've loved growing up, and I've had to express myself in the same way, hoping that they would appreciate it. And most have, and some, you know, don't know how to express that, so I just take it for what it is. I always think of Guru, when he say he meet motherfuckers, shake their hand, they'll be all spitting in my face. You know what I'm saying? And you shake your hand and the hand, and you keep it moving. A lot of people don't know how to do that, but this time is different, so I appreciate it a lot more because, like y'all say, you know, especially in this era that we in right now, all our favorites are getting older. So, you know, I take a different pride in doing this now, and I don't take it for granted at all. Every trip, every tour, every person that I meet, I store that shit in my memory bank, and I let them know how much, you know, I'm humbled by the fact that they even listen to anything me and Tame ever did. That's the only reason why I'm talking to y'all today.
Man, but like I said, for y'all to leave a legacy like that, because like I said, between a rock and a hard place, it just to me, and I guess also with the video, the visuals, like I said, to me it just encompassed everything that hip-hop represents, from the grittiness of the streets, you know, the guerrilla bombing in terms of spray painting, you know, graffiti, and just ill rhymes. You all probably, you know, just represent, I think, in terms of the essence of everything, you know, just really representing that the culture in such a distinguished fashion. I think that's why I love, you know, y'all debut so much, because it really, to me, encompasses all the elements of hip hop into one, you know. And I love Illmatic, you know, but y'all album is definitely, you know, from 94, you know, is, and people might get mad on YouTube, you know, or might say I'm trying to suck up, but I don't give a fuck. To me, the albums, the in no particular order, is Illmatic, y'all's, and then Biggie's. And I only say Illmatic first because I heard Halftime back in 1992 off of the Zebrahead soundtrack, and when I first heard that kid, I was like, "Yo,
yeah, he taking it back with that."
I was at the album release party. So I know what you're talking about. I only went there because I wanted to see him do that song.
Yeah, but that was like 2 years before, you know, the record would drop. But when I first heard Halftime, I was like, yo, who is this kid? You know, because of course he had like 2 years earlier, you know, been on Main Source of Live at the Barbecue, and then the next year on MC Search's second album, Return of Product, he was on Back to the Grill again, you know, and then 92, you know, he does Halftime, and we're just, like, blown away. Of course, 94, winter, January 94 is when he would drop It Ain't Hard to Tell. And then the album, I believe, would drop in April 21st, I want to say 1994. You know, but like I said, you know, well, y'all, Nas and Biggie dropped in 94 was just, this was culture shifting. This was a game changer. This was something that hip-hop in a good way would never be the same again after what y'all did.
Right, and I would say I was at only because at the time we made that song and those records and acknowledging the four elements of hip-hop, nobody was talking about it. No one on record. No one ever thought to make a graffiti anthem song. Nothing like that of the sort. So when we came, it was different. And next thing you know, everything blew up. Like, it was like an explosion of, you know, everybody talking about the elements of hip hop. Every panel, every we used to do the Gavin and the what is this? Jack the Rapper, you talking about New Music Seminar, all of a sudden these things were being brought to light, because at the time, you know, nobody was interested in talking about graffiti as being an element of hip-hop, and no, these are things that, you know, because at the time we did that, it was still early for hip-hop in the sense of business, in a sense of, like, the sound of it, because at the time of, say, 92 to 94 to 95, you got all these records coming in from Pete Rock, you got Smooth, Brand Nubian, you know, KMD, Alkoholics, just
shout
Wu-Tang,
out to
Naughty,
KMD,
like,
man, rest in peace, Sub Rock,
KMD, because that's who they were in the beginning. So when you had all these records coming out, it was through production that were done by people that were still inventing the sound of it through these machines. So when you look at Lars Pro, and you look at B-Nuts, and you look at P-Rock, and you look at Q-Tip, you look at even Dilla coming in early with what he was doing with the artists who I even name, even say De La Soul, to Busta, to Q-Tip and them with the Umma. You know, these production styles were being perfected in a time where they could only flourish in the time span to, say, to 98, where the big money started to come into play, where the labels started changing up the lineup. They started changing the lineup. And so the only route for all of us to go with our sound was the independent route. And say where you know, independent record labels pressing up so much records, and Fat Beast distribution, and a lot of things, you know, started going that way. So all of the artists that was on major labels started going to the independent route, where you see even today, like Pete Rock, still put out records today, whether he with himself making an instrumental album, or doing one with Sky Zoo, doing one with Smoke Dizza. You know, he was able to maneuver in a time where production producers like him and Primo, you know, people thought would probably go to the leeway, where you look at Primo working with Royce, whether he working with, you know, Still Remixes, and, you know, working with Christina Aguilera, he still was able to move. So, yeah, you know, that separates them from where I say the time frame where people are still interested in that sound, even from them.
Definitely. L, you know, man, you know it goes without saying, you're welcome back on the show anytime. We hope to get, you know, he's more than welcome to come on. We're about to, because we don't want Blog Talk on his off. This has been an honor, legend. Thank you so much. We appreciate you so much, man.
Before I get out of here, I want to say one thing before I go. Y'all can all look forward to everybody at the sound of my voice in the next couple of months. This year, the Artifacts will be putting out an album entirely produced by Buck Wild, DITC.
We are here for it. Yes.
No doubt. Yes. The name of the album is called No Expiration Date. No Expiration Date is the name of the album. So
we're
going to Smoke On Records, coming out of Germany. So y'all be ready for that very soon.
You know y'all got to come back and tell us about this.
Oh, no doubt. That's definitely. I'm going to get Tane to get on the call, too.
Definitely, man.
Hell yeah, let's get it.
Yeah, man.
I got you. I'll let y'all know when the release date and everything so we can set up the next one.
Definitely, man. Appreciate you so much, man. And,
thank y'all for having me, man, you know. And my next one, beat San Antonio. That's what's up.
Hey, Big Apple's still growing, man. So, look, y'all just keep looking.
Even though I'm a Jersey dude,
like,
and the Nets then left, they went to Brooklyn, but, hey, we good. I thank y'all again.
Look, y'all drop them apples like Johnny Appleseed, man. Let them know the Big Apple's back, man. Spread the fruit.
No doubt. All right.
Definitely. All right, man. So
that's what it is, bro. We're going to definitely keep in tune, man.
No doubt, yo. Y'all be good, man.
Yes, sir.
No doubt.
All right.
Again.
I'll talk to y'all
soon. Brother, out.
Peace.
Peace out.
All right.